My guest this afternoon is Judith Birkin, a civil rights lawyer and law professor who has lived for many years in the old city of San Juan, Puerto Rico. I had a unique opportunity about 1 year ago to talk to Judy, who had the experience of going through what happened when Hurricane Maria made landfall on Puerto Rico as a Category 4/5 hurricane, and is currently living through still with our fellow American Puerto Ricans what's going on down there since the hurricane left a year ago. Last time we spoke, Judy gave us an on-the-ground report of conditions in San Juan 45 days after Maria left. She is now here to talk about what's going on since and what she sees for the future for Puerto Rico. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, like I said, you gave us a pretty good idea what was happening then, you know, blackouts and, you know, no street lights and no stoplights and things like that. Can you give us a brief overview of how you see what's progressed since a year ago?
Well, you know, it's been a mixed bag. We're now 16 months after the storm. And we're still feeling the effects. There was a report in the newspaper the other day that only a third of the lampposts on the island are actually working. So there are pretty hazardous conditions on our roads still. They're still in a lot of communities, and I also lived in the countryside for 32 years, not only in Old San Juan. And, you know, the countryside is a lot harder hit than the metropolitan area, and there's still a great number of people without roofs still at this point. The economy still hasn't, shot back. We were having terrific problems before the hurricane hit with overwhelming debt, et cetera, and austerity measures being started with the imposition of a fiscal control board. So that's really, which is a dictatorial board that supersedes our elected government. And this is happening under U.S. Power, and the Congress of the United States has imposed this. So we have that. We also have a great deal of ongoing problems with agriculture, which has not been able to reach its pre-storm levels, and it's always been a problem on the island because of our being food dependent on other countries, not other countries, the United States, basically, which controls the shipping to the island and also controls what products enter to the island. And we've also always had a problem of dumping of U.S. goods on the island, undercutting local agriculture. There have been some ongoing agricultural products, but the damage to agriculture, I don't recall the exact amount, but I do recall something in the nature of $10 billion.
Whoa.
Now, while this is going on, the total hurricane cost has been estimated about $90 billion, which is even greater than our debt, which is $72 billion, not counting the electrical company and the pension systems. That's just the central government debt. So we're sort of being hit, all over by a lot of different things. The migration, there have been a lot of different estimates of migration, and I hate to speak incorrectly, but there has been massive migration. It's something you feel very much. And, of course, it's taking out a large degree of our younger people. People entering the workforce, it's hard to recruit, actually, workers who are at entry-level jobs right now because so many of them have left. It's also hitting our medical personnel. We have trouble getting hospital visits here or doctor visits, mejor dicho, doctor visits, and because a lot of the doctors have migrated. This was occurring prior to the hurricane, but after the hurricane it was even more dramatic, and that has to do with some of the treatment we've been getting from Washington, which I'm sure some of your listeners have heard about, but Trump has it in for a lot of things, but he certainly has it in for Puerto Rico and is very reluctant to agree, in fact, will not agree to Medicare parity. We pay the same tax for Medicare, but we don't get parity in terms of the reimbursements. So a lot of the doctors have left the island. And there was also storm damage. There's a major medical center in Manati where a great number of professionals have offices, and a lot of those offices were just completely destroyed in September of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Trump has also, I'll say two more things and then I'll let you ask a question, but there's also been the withholding of a lot of the relief funds by some odious statements by Trump as to, you know, us being lazy and things like that, and we shouldn't get the relief. And right now there's a struggle over block grants that are being given pursuant to relief packages passed by Congress. And the executive is not wanting to release the packages to Puerto Rico or to give money to HUD. And the last thing I'm going to say as an introductory matter, there's so much to say, but the last thing I'm going to say is that, you know, we've had an influx of money because of some of the funds that came in either through volunteer funds, private donations, and also public grants. But the contracting is largely by off-island contractors who came in, many of whom just established their companies in order to come into Puerto Rico and charge really excessive rates rather than give that employment to the people of Puerto Rico, which would help to jumpstart our economy.
What is the general feeling of the people of Puerto Rico? Is there the ruling power is sort of liking what Trump's doing for the island, and the people aren't? Or explain to me what you think is going on in that regard.
You know, it's a complex situation because there are many forces at play, and the political alignments in the context of Puerto Rico are not really comparable to what you have up in the States. Our parties are not organized around Democratic, Republican, and, you know, at different times in a single party, you may have people supporting Trump, like the resident commissioner, Jennifer Gonzalez, but the governor technically doesn't support him. So those are those things. But if you talk about the people of Puerto Rico, I don't claim to speak for the people of Puerto Rico. I can just give you a sense of what I've observed, and people are furious at Trump, obviously, because we're really suffering down here still. And this is, you know, as I say, a year and 4 months after the hurricane, and we are suffering. But then there's another element, which is the Fiscal Control Board. And you really can't talk about the hurricane relief without talking about the Fiscal Control Board, because their policies for Puerto Rico, and they basically veto all fiscal decisions in Puerto Rico. Any legislation with a fiscal consequence must be passed by the seven-member board, which is made up of financial interests, basically.
And where do they get their power from?
A law of Congress that was passed in June of 2016 called Promesa, which is promise in Spanish, and it's a very badly named law. But the law was passed by Congress, but it had a bipartite support in Congress, and it was under Obama in the last year of his administration. And the idea was to name a seven-member board that would basically take all fiscal decisions with respect to Puerto Rico. And this is a year before the hurricane. But that first year, it was kind of getting into play, and the people were named, and they started making some decisions. But since the hurricane, it's everything is on the table again. But there is a fiscal plan approved by the board, which has projections for extraordinary growth that economists say is not going to happen, and also calls for austerity measures. And the board has been very active in limiting labor rights, for example, that kind of thing. So right now the struggle on the financial area is also before the court, because the Promesa law has designed in such a way that a federal court, and in this case it's a bankruptcy judge from New York, Laura Taylor Swain, governs the equivalent of a bankruptcy filing by the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. And right now there are negotiations going on with different groups of bondholders, and the most important one, which is currently in play, is called COFINA, which is an acronym for a issuance of bonds collateralized by our sales tax, which is at 11.5%. And if that, it's still pending whether it's going to be approved. The hearings were held on the 16th and 17th of January before the U.S. District Court here in Puerto Rico, which is a federal court, and before Taylor Swain. And the deal will basically mortgage the future of Puerto Rico and really, I believe, make economic recovery totally impossible.
So let's explain it a little better. The COFINA, no, just for the average person out there who I'm sure has never heard of a COFINA bond. And so that in Puerto Rico, it was decided by this junta, I've heard you call them, and also the person in New York that's overseeing this sort of bankruptcy of Puerto Rico. They've sold bonds to people who have money to finance the repairs and the functioning parts of the island. Correct me if I'm wrong. And now they got to get paid back.
All right, the COFINA, the law came into effect before all this in 2006, but there were some bond issuances in 2013 and 2014, even before PROMESA, and there was a grab and a purchase by the vulture funds after the hurricane at deeply discounted rates. Mm-hmm. They purchased bonds, according to COFINA, guaranteed by our sales tax.
And what was that money going to be used for?
Supposedly, the money was going to be used for ongoing projects in Puerto Rico. But it hasn't been, because all we use the money for is to pay off more of our debt.
Oh, okay.
What you have is debt upon debt, right? And part of the problem is, and the U.S. is going that route, too, because they have a $23 trillion debt. But there comes to a point where, think of it as your mortgage. If you refinance and refinance and refinance your mortgage, you're ending up not paying anything to principal, and what you're doing is paying to pay off the debt and refinancing, getting sums of cash to pay off the debt. So a typical situation with the COFINA issue at this point is that these vulture funds came down and bought these bonds at very, very discounted rates, and now they are before the federal court. They originally claimed 100%, but now the deal will give them something in the order of 59% of the immediate money deposited, all right, which has been deposited for the last 2 years without distribution to the bondholders. And then they will refinance the bonds, or actually create new bonds, which are capital appreciation bonds, so our underlying debt will continue to increase. And the analysis says that, something that started out as, well, it started when the bankruptcy proceeding as an $18 billion debt is going to be increased by $32 billion.
And so what do you think should happen other than just giving in to this group of bondholders?
Well, it's not only that group, because there are other groups coming behind it. But I think we have to really audit the debt and see how much of it is unconstitutional. There's an argument that the entire COFINA debt is unconstitutional because there were constitutional limits on issuance of that debt. And I do think the United States has to take responsibility for the debt. Anything that remains, that it cannot come from our coffers, because that's what is totally draining Puerto Rico. I should indicate also, as you stated, I call it the Junta, because everybody calls it here the Junta, and it's called the Junta in Español. But the Junta is paid for by our funds, our taxes. And even though it's a creature of the federal government, it was conceived of as an entity, quote-unquote, within the Puerto Rico government and paid for by the people of Puerto Rico. So it has been a full employment program for lawyers and accountants and, financiers from the states to really, they are charging outrageous sums of money to manage the situation and to deal with their own analysis of the debt. But there have been calls from day one for an auditing of all our debt, not just the COFINA debt, which is it's $18 billion out of $72 billion, but all the debt, because we are fearful that we're talking about percentages in the range of 200%, that kind of thing. I'm not giving an exact number, because the debt is debt upon debt upon debt.
What is the likelihood that this will have an outcome that would be helpful and benefit the majority of Puerto Ricans, or will it just end up being beneficial for the junta, the ruling powers, and these people who have invested in bonds?
Well, you're talking to a person who is quite depressed about all this. It's hard to see a way out where the U.S. would really take its own responsibility for this. And if not, there will be these deals with the bondholders, which will only further strangle the people of Puerto Rico. And the concomitant demands from the junta are extreme austerity. You can look at the example of Greece and the IMF and the European Union, and that the Greek people still here, years out, are still suffering austerity measures, and though growth is beginning to increase because it hits so low, it still doesn't hit for the benefit of the people. It's a kind of worldwide phenomenon. I think it's very important for people in the United States to understand it, because this is being done in your name, as with the hurricane relief and all the difficulties we've had in getting relief or in ensuring that the economy gets jump-started by all these people coming in, and instead all the money's leaving Puerto Rico.
And I see from things you've written that the junta is insisting on major cuts in pensions and labor reforms, impoverishing more of the natives and attracting outside investment into the island.
Yes.
At the expense of Puerto Rico.
I also want to mention the University of Puerto Rico, which is being severely attacked. And if there's anything we need, it's a center for knowledge. And so students used to be that the University of Puerto Rico was really a sense of pride in Puerto Rico. And students, top-level students, instead of studying in the States, at least at the undergraduate level, would go to the University of Puerto Rico, and also sometimes at the graduate level. But that has been changing also, and they've really been attacking the budget of the University of Puerto Rico. And the austerity measures are also, the board is insisting on austerity measures with respect to private employment, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that the idea of attracting investments has obviously a downside on the tax concessions that have been granted for new businesses to come into Puerto Rico. I'm litigating a case right now where we're trying to get the information on a report that the Puerto Rico government has given to the junta about all its tax abatements, concessions, credits, etc. And the government is refusing to give the people of Puerto Rico access to that report. But if we see that, we can see the real cost of tax abatements. I should mention also our Law 20 and Law 22, which are dubbed in Puerto Rico as the Millionaire's Law, because they're two laws that allow very, very wealthy individuals to establish themselves in Puerto Rico if they spend 181 days here a year, and then they get to pay 0% on any business, it's subject to certain limitations, but essentially export businesses that they can establish, and 4% on every one of their incomes, whether they be passive income such as stocks or bonds, or whether they be active income. They don't, through actual economic activity, production or service.
Right. So it sort of gives them an independent fiefdom right in the middle of Puerto Rico, right? I mean, that's why it's attracting some of the Bitcoin people, I understand.
Exactly. Bitcoin people, I live in a fairly upscale condominium, and its character has changed in the last couple of years because there's a lot of U.S. people down here, and they're people who are totally unconnected with Puerto Rico, most of them. They don't have any requirement that they have to go to local businesses for their supplies or anything like that. They don't do any of that. They have to hire, I think, 3 people or something like that. And then they get to pay a tax rate of 4%, where the rest of us are paying, in the 40s or 30s.
Mm-hmm. And I understand because of the hurricane, there's been a lot of problems with FEMA and denying greater number of people land titles, and therefore they can't get their land back. They can't get repairs done because they can't get insurance on what happened because they can't show they own the land.
Yeah, that's it's been a major problem. There are a lot of wonderful people working on ayuda legal, help, legal assistance for the people after the hurricane. But one of the major things is a whole lot of people, I don't know the exact percentage, in Puerto Rico do not have land titles because the way land use got developed was very different from in the States. You know, in the urban areas, you'll have land titles, but in most of the rural areas, or even in the urban areas, in the poorer neighborhoods, there will not be land titles. This was land which was, quote-unquote, rescued by someone, and it could be 3 or 4 generations back, but they do not qualify for FEMA, because they don't have the land titles. So that's been a real problem. We've also had major problems with insurance claims. Only a small sector of the population actually had insurance, but those who did have insurance, they have us over the barrel because it's close to being monopolistic. I mean, there are several insurance companies, but they are raising premiums like crazy. Where I live, the claim is probably less than what the increase in the insurance premium has been.
Mm-hmm. So, I would imagine that this has the effect of encouraging speculators and sort of picking up and picking off the good stuff that's now available because it can't be proved that they own it and they can't get repairs done and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of people are abandoning homes. There's a lot of abandoned buildings. Some of them have bank loans, the ones with titles, and those are also being picked off. And also the Promesa law that I spoke of earlier, which established the Junta. The Junta has a quote, infrastructure czar, whose purpose it has been to identify public lands that are not currently being used to good use, as they claim, and selling them off. So I'll give you one small example, which is we have an urban train here, which is a kind of subway, and it's not getting great use, but when it gets used, people drive to the parking lot of where the subway train runs and then board the train. Well, one of the parking lots they just sold off at a deep, deep, deep discount to private interests. And now we're going to have to pay for those services where before we just got to park in the parking lot of the train.
Very interesting.
That kind of thing is occurring all over the place, and there's going to be pitched battles over land grabs by the junta.
Sure. We're talking to Judith Birkin. She's a civil rights lawyer and law professor living in San Juan, Puerto Rico. She has a law office down there, and she's letting us in on some of the stuff that's going on that we don't see. You know, it's the news cycle up here, 6 days and it's gone. And they're still dealing with lots of stuff there. What is it that your office is working on specifically to help out?
What we're doing right now, I should say my practice over 45 years has been civil rights cases, and so all those cases were stayed under the PROMESA bill. So if a police officer kills somebody, for example, they can't litigate the case anymore. So it's given free rein for violation of civil rights. But one of the few areas where we've had some success is in getting information from the government, because we have very strong laws here on freedom of information. And so I have been working, right now I'm working on two major cases. One is the one I mentioned earlier, where we're trying to get the information as to the tax abatements, tax concessions, and tax credits, which will, which are really a hidden cost of government. And that information, we want to be able to divulge it and to use it in the PROMESA litigation to show that the government priorities are somewhat off. That's one. And the second case I've been working at is we have been, and that's in representation of an organization called Espacios Abiertos, Open Spaces. And then another litigation I've been working on is to get information regarding the internal operations of the junta and their communications with both the federal government and with the government of Puerto Rico. And we're about halfway through that. That I'm doing on behalf of a great organization called the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo, which is the investigative journalism center, who were the people who revealed, for example, that they were the initial people who went out and figured out that the official government estimate of 64 deaths was crazy with respect to the hurricane, and really motivated the interest in the states on that. And that the information we're now asking for are all the reports and communications between the board and the two governments.
Well, good luck with that. I hope it works out.
Yeah,
wait,
we're working
so, okay,
on it.
Here, I'm going to make you the head of the junta. What do you think is the best thing to happen to improve the middle and lower classes lot in Puerto Rico?
We've got to change the whole economic focus. We are in a focus which is an equivalent of gentrification of an entire country, where you will have a very high-end class, usually from outside, that will enjoy all the spoils of our land and our people. And the middle sector will probably have migrated, and then there will be a very poor, either unemployed or employed in the service sector to service those in that high class. And so I think we just have to change the model to self-sufficiency, to look for agricultural sufficiency, to go back in some ways away from the industrialization, which moved Puerto Rico forward in many ways, but no longer works in an economy such as the world economy today. And obviously, I think if we had independence, we would have the ability to do things we cannot do now, which is like our control our imports, control migration to the island, those kinds of things, and look for some real development, control dumping of agricultural products, which destroys our local agriculture. So it's a little bit of not doing what we're doing. And there are great, to not give a totally depressing picture, there are efforts of small groups doing micro businesses or doing agricultural projects on a collectivized basis. But right now we're in the stranglehold of the financiers, and until we get rid of that and the United States recognizes its responsibility for doing this, which was on their watch, the debt accumulation in Puerto Rico, until we do that, we will not be moving forward.
Any likelihood that this, what you're talking about, may happen? Sorry.
Let's be hopeful. Let's try to be optimistic. There are movements here in Puerto Rico, but we are under direct colonial control, and it's hard. But, those of you in the States who work within the Democratic Party, these messages have to get out. And it's very, you have to understand that the PROMESA board and the junta was formed under the Obama administration with bipartisan support, with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer each naming a member of the board, and the same thing with Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Obama. So you know, we can't really expect much until the United States recognizes that it's still a colonial power and that it has to change. We're talking about, you know, control that's based on a model that was developed at the end of the 19th century for a 21st century economy and a world that is unfortunately returning to neocolonialism in a way that's very harmful. And we have direct colonialism here.
Yeah.
Let's try to be optimistic.
Okay. So let's try to get our audience to participate a little bit. What can somebody here do? What would be a real thing to do? Contact their representatives, try to influence the Democratic Party to make change?
Yeah. I mean, the PROMESA bill is coming up for renegotiation. And so that would be, you know, since there are more progressive people in the Congress now than I believe in any time in recent history, I think getting people, the new progressives within the Democratic Party, educated first about Puerto Rico so that they understand what the baseline problems are and the perniciousness of colonialism. And so there's those things could be looked at. Right now, I think there are struggles going on that should be dealt with to the degree you guys up there can do things on a legislative basis around the withholding of aid, HUD, the block grants under HUD, the emergency relief grants that Trump is trying to withhold from Puerto Rico, Medicare parity, where we pay into Medicare the same as you pay, but we end up getting much less in terms of potential reimbursements. I think the Jones Act is an important thing to look at because it requires that it's throughout the United States, but it requires that all shipping to and from any port that's designated a U.S. port must be done on U.S. ships with U.S. workers and under U.S. flag. And that makes imports to the island extremely expensive. So that's another thing that could be looked at. And in general, educating the people about colonialism, and that most people in the United States don't realize that the United States retains, I believe it's 5 colonies, and Puerto Rico is its biggest one. And I would also say, you know, it's not because we are American citizens that we should get decent treatment after a storm of the nature that we have experienced and continue to experience. It's because, you know, the United States retains Puerto Rico as a colony and prohibits certain types of economic development. And so it has a special responsibility.
Well, Judith Bergen, thank you so much for this report. It was illuminating, and I hope we can get some people fired up to do something to help you out a little bit.
Kevin, I want to thank you for your continuing interest, and I hope that your listeners are interested as well.
Okay. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye-bye.